You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. The following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
Well, guys, thank you for tuning into the main course. We have an amazing show that we put together today. Three of the biggest movers and shakers in the restaurant industry from all different aspects of the restaurant industry. Our first guest is Maya Martinez. She's the owner of Sample Wine Bar in Carroll Gardens. Our second guest today is Cecilia Estridge. She is a sales associate for Makuni Wild Harvest, which basically provides some of the top restaurants with truffles and mushrooms in New York City. And our third guest is a mixologist extraordinaire. She's currently working at Maison Premier and has worked in some of the top mixology places, restaurants, bars, if you will, in New York. That is Patrick knocking on a window to some of his friends.
Tell him to turn the music down out there.
Oh,
okay, what kind of place are we broadcasting in?
We're
no, just
feedback.
Kidding. We should say broadcasting out of. Have you introduced all three guests already?
I have introduced all three guests. I am Jason Colucci, and to my immediate future is Patrick Martins.
Don Sitter.
Broadway.
I would like to say we're broadcasting out of Roberta's restaurant at 261 Moore Street out of two repurposed shipping containers, and this is HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We also got Sam Jr. in the back. Son of Sam Edwards, which is a really big sponsor of Heritage Radio Network. They make all the prosciutto.
Oh, forget about it.
Virginia, you know.
I didn't know. I just
American prosciutto. Well, I have an announcement. I love when I get emails from anyone within the Bastianich and Batali Empire.
Yeah, you have to read. You have to read those, or you won't get a reservation.
It means they still remember that I exist because they do buy a lot of stuff from us. They're doing a cuisine in the country dinner in Las Vegas, and they're going to roast whole goats. It's $100 a person, and it's basically to honor, you know, this whole network of ranchers and producer cooperatives and this and that. So LincolnCountyNevada.com. So
that's it? There's no more?
No, $100. Oh. I mean, the chefs, Mario Batali's, Las Vegas restaurants, B&B, Carnivino, and Italian Steakhouse, and Otto, are partnering with the Lincoln County, Nevada Producers Cooperative for the second year to bring you cuisine in the country. Well, it's going to be a great event.
It's going to be a great event, and when I think of culinary, sort of the Mecca, I think in Las Vegas, at least, it's in my top three, definitely.
Really?
Well, yeah, definitely. After... sorry.
Do you really think that? Because
no,
you know,
I mean,
for art, it is. Like, there's
no, I mean,
great art house there. There's
yeah,
great chefs.
Steve Wynn is a great curator of Picasso's. No, I mean, there's some fun stuff. You're talking about Vegas as a whole is like any other city. If you're there for a little while, you can find the little gems of it if you get through the sort of the fluff of it. And I agree with you 100% about, you know, restaurants.
How much time have you spent there?
Well, I wouldn't consider any of the time I spent there actual time because there were like 3-day stints where I probably didn't sleep very much.
Sleep at all.
Yeah, exactly. So
wonder
I don't know
how that happened.
Time actually existed.
Well, so great job producing the show. This was all you. I mean, I was
thank
just given my marching orders.
Well, thank
for
you
today.
For trusting me, and thank you for all our guests. I really have to say that these are people that I'm friends with and I work with, and people I really respect, and I visit their restaurants and I do business with Cecilia. So I really appreciate everyone's time today and really
Cecilia
excited.
Said that you were one of her top 85 chefs below 14th Street. So I thought that was kind of cool.
It is with 3,000 restaurants in New York City. It kind of
top 70.
Numbers work. Yeah, the numbers work. But no, you talked about. Well, first of all, I have to say when I did the Cecilia's bio, Cecilia worked at a what is the actual name of the
place?
Consider Bardwell. I put Don Sitter Bardwell, and just
because you're you know an Italian, well, Don's.
Don, of course. But just so everyone knows the level of like farm geek that Patrick Martins is, he looked at the entire thing, and the only thing that he said about the entire sheet of everyone's bio was, There's a little misspelling about this small little farm up there in Vermont.
How dare they?
I was like, what
dare
you talking
spell
about?
Check not
How, he's
know
like,
them?
I was like, what do you mean? Well, listen, this is a very respected goat farm up there. I was like, all right, we'll change the thing and redo it.
My big issue was that you would go with Don Sitter. That's like in that Seinfeld episode where he knew his girlfriend's names rhymed with the part of the female anatomy, and he went with Mulva.
Mulva.
That's like going with Don Sitter.
You know? I went with it. We were on a phone interview, you know, running around, and I had asked her 100 other questions, and I couldn't, you know, and I was writing it down, and
Well, introduce our first guest.
All right. Our first guest today is Mayo Martinez. Martinez is the owner of Sample, a wine and conserver bar that has evolved over the past 8 years in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn. Before entering the world of becoming a wine bar owner, she was a pastry chef in New York City and France, working for some top chefs such as David Boulay and Claudia Fleming. She then opened Biscuit in Park Slope, Brooklyn, with two other partners. Biscuit was one of the first nouveau barbecue places to rise out of the New York City landscape and was widely successful. It closed after 3 years for creative differences, and with the capital earned from Brisket, the concept of Sample Wine Bar came along. Sample, a simple wine bar serving conserva-style food, which she picked up after a trip to Spain. We are pleased to have to the show Mayo Martinez.
Hi, Jason. Mayo. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you for coming. You know what? Can you talk a little bit about Sample Wine Bar, which is sort of the name, but there's food served there. I've consumed it. Can you say how food fits into the picture at Sample?
Well, we have wine. We have food. They you know, certainly complement each other. The food at Sample is conservas, and mainly what we wanted to do, my partner and I, when we opened Sample, was to have a great little venue for tasting the two together. And originally we sort of patterned it after a place in Barcelona called Quimet a Quimet. And it's this really great little neighborhood place that's serving bocadillos, and their bocadillos have conservas instead of having fresh ingredients. And
bocadillos being sardines?
Bocadillos are little bites. Okay. So, yeah, so when you go into a tapas bar, if they have the, you know, there are lots of different styles of tapas. Anyway, so, you know, Quimet a Quimet definitely was inspirational because, you know, for my partner and I, two chefs, thinking about food cost constantly, having the idea of a place that that has, like, you know, ostensibly zero loss was really, really interesting. So that's how Sample was brought up.
Do you have to have, so you have the idea of a wine bar and stuff, and do you have to if you're serving wine, if you open a wine bar, do you have to have food?
Well, no, certainly you don't. But I think that it enhances, you know, the experience of your wine and your food, of your, you know, of you know, they complement each other.
It allows people to drink more too.
No,
oh,
Maya,
definitely.
Maya, you brought a good point, which I thought was spot on when I first asked you that question, which was, in New York you don't, or New York you do. I forget what the answer was, but you had, no, it was a perfect answer because it was
Well, you know, I thought you were asking me, you know, we were talking about another project and my mind was in, you know, the legalities of New York, and there are all these crazy old laws, and so, you know, you can't dance and you can't, you know, do spit, or you can't, God knows what you can't do. You know, there are lots
which
of things.
Which of those two upsets you more?
You know, the dancing, although I do like a spit every once in a while. But you know, definitely I was thinking about, you know, what is legal, and, you know, in a lot of states you have to have some food when you have alcohol, and that seems reasonable, but it doesn't, you know, it's one of those laws that, you know, like any of the others that kind of like guide you to the right path. I can take those or leave them, but for New York, no, you don't have to have food.
Well,
I personally think that it's very important.
Yeah, I mean, everyone likes to eat. I try to eat three, 4 times a day. So now, tell us about the spectrum of canned foods and things that you can look for to determine freshness or quality or artisanship, even though it's coming in traditionally what people imagine, you know, a non-fresh situation, although obviously there are many fresh foods. So.
Certainly. Well, you know, I mean, most of the conservas that I have are coming from other countries. So, you know, they have a very long tradition of putting together you know, the very best of whatever the harvest was, or the catch was. And so it's kind of, it's almost like a no-brainer. Like any sort of like Japanese or Spanish fish in a can is going to be fantastic. And, you know, any kind of, you know, olive coming from Italy or from Peru is also going to be delicious. So, you know, there are guidelines that are just sort of like a usual. But there are also, you know, I mean, certainly there are like really tiny little places that make things that almost never come to this country. So when I see those, I get really excited. Certainly cheeses being one of those preserved foods, not technically a conserva, but I treat it as such. And cheeses are huge for me. I love, you know, tasting different things and going and, you know, seeing the animals that are actually producing the milk and that sort of thing. So that's really fun for me.
Are there certain things you cannot do? I mean, you've worked with David Boulay and Claudia Fleming, which I want to ask you about. But, I mean, the fact that you're only using canned foods, are there certain things that you wish you could do but that canning doesn't allow you? Or and then also in the same question, what else can you do?
Well, you know, I don't have a salad on the menu. Mm-hmm. So there's that. You know, but again, with the whole thing of I have... you know, beautiful wines. I have lots of wines from everywhere. I have a full bar of lots of sort of like different kinds of liquors that I like to mix up and really nice craft beers. So with those things, you know, as you said earlier, what I really want is to have salgados. So things that are salty, that make you want to drink, that kind of, you know, you have a refreshment in your beverage.
And what, do you use Spanish wines mostly?
I love Spanish wine. But, you know, I love Spanish wine. I love Italian wine. I love French wine. I love, you know, lots of different countries give us great wines.
I think when we first met, one of the things that when I was at the place what really interested me about you was you had been a part of a restaurant that I knew in Park Slope called Biscuit.
Isn't it Biscuit? No, it's Biscuit, right?
Well, you know, I don't know. Here in the U.S., we say Biscuit.
I remembered going to that place and getting just a quick takeout, and it was, it just all of a sudden disappeared. But it was an amazing restaurant.
Why did you call it Nouveau in your outline?
Well, I called it Nouveau because there was an entire sort of group of restaurants that opened, I would say, after Biscuit. And barbecue places, whether it be Blue Smoke or whatever you want to call it. I don't say Nouveau, where they were doing sort of new techniques with barbecue. I just meant Nouveau.
Blue Smoke was open.
Had opened already.
Daisy Mays was not.
Daisy Mays was not.
Yeah.
It was just a general like sort of level of new barbecue, sort of Americana kind of places that opened. So I used the word Nouveau just to sort of make it sound very interesting, but it was eventually just
pioneer.
New.
Yeah, we were pioneers.
And you were specifically doing North Carolina style barbecue.
Yes.
One, please tell me what, when you guys were getting the money together to open Biscuit, what sort of the thought process was in opening a barbecue place?
Well, actually, you know, it's an interesting thing because at that point, I'd been in New York. I'd been cooking for about 8 years, and I came to New York to go to culinary school. So, you know, I drove from California and went to CIA, and my partner went to Johnson & Wales, and so both classically trained. So, you know, maybe a little bit odd that our first venture was Carolina Barbecue. But really, you know, it's one of those things. When you're working on the line in New York, you're working with everybody, people who you would never, ever meet otherwise. And, you know, after years of working with different people and learning about the food, you know, from where they are, that kind of seeped in. And I, you know, I firmly believe that that is the most organic and the most natural way for a restaurant to, you know, become. So that's kind of, you know, and in fact, Sample was the original idea. So Biscuit came only after we had thought about Sample. And Sample was this epiphany, this like, you know, kind of shining ideal that we were like, that's what we want to do. We, however, did not have the capital for it. And we funded everything ourselves. So it was my partner and I and a friend of ours. So it was three of us throwing in, you know, our wads of money and building this little tiny place.
And barbecue seemed very organic because it's sort of a low overhead kind of
It was fairly low overhead. It was really, I mean, if you looked at the place,
it was literally, there was about five tables when you walked in, and then there was like a little counter, and then that was it. I mean, I remember,
teeny tiny.
Well, I can't wait to try this this new wine bar Sample, because my favorite wine bar right now is Bouvette.
Oh, I love Bouvette.
You know, and I think she does food in such an original way. So I always try to hold things up to that standard. Of course, it's way in the West Village, and that's not near me. But, I mean, do you have a website and stuff like that where people can...
Do you know, it's actually not up right now. It's getting tweaked a little bit, but hopefully so what are your hours,
and how can people reserve? We'll tag it for the website.
Oh, fantastic. Every day we're open, and it's open at a very... lovely hour of 5 p.m.
You do a great
until
happy
midnight.
Hour.
Yeah, 5 p.m. until midnight, and then on Friday and Saturday until 2 o'clock.
Okay, and then what's the exact address?
The address is 152 Smith Street, and that's at Bergen. So it's really great because the F and the G are right there at the Bergen stop.
Yeah, so. Downtown Brooklyn, Carl Gardens. That's a very interesting restaurant scene. You know, there was Prime Meats and Frankie's all the way down
that
there.
That was, I mean, that was...
Then Rucola, now Mile End.
But there was that whole... You're part of that whole first wave of Smith Street, though, that whole French wave.
Samples, actually, we came after, Bar Tabac and Banania, but Samples going to be 8 years October.
And you're doing your new place?
And I am. I'm super excited. I've got... a wine shop in the works, and I met my partners, who are now my friends and partners, at Sample. So over the years of pouring people wine, and I love to play. I love to see what people are into, stretch them a little bit, give them a little bit of like something different, give them something to pair something that's going to kind of blow their minds and like get them thinking. And so with that, I met these great guys and we're opening a wine shop. It's beautiful. It's down.
Where is it?
It's down in One Brooklyn Bridge Park, which looks out on the Brooklyn Bridge, the city, and that 25-mile-long park, which is amazing. It's not, it's not finished, but it's a really great.
When all those people move in, it'll be a really great. And now this wine shop will have red, white, and rosé?
Well, rosé only in the summer.
Kidding me?
That's awesome.
We're going to have it all.
That is going to be, that's One Brooklyn Bridge, right? That's going to be a really cool park. It's already cool. You cannot jog down the entire length of it because it's still not done, but there's like kayaks.
Are you jogging? Or are you just seeing people? Are you talking about people? Lots. Are you talking about people you see jogging? Or
No, people. I imagine people jogging. I've actually never been there.
You can actually go all the way down. There are parts of it that are in construction, so they're not pretty. Yeah. But they are, but there is the pathway there and you can see, the potential. So it's really nice.
And right now the only restaurant there is that famous pizza place that people stupidly stand in line for like 3 hours and like the River Cafe.
Wait, wait. If you walk 4 blocks down, you have Vinegar Hill House. Come on.
Oh yeah.
That's true.
Which I love. Yeah.
Vinegar Hill is a very good restaurant. Mm-hmm. Well, you're going to sit in. I love it. This is like the old Johnny Carson. You will just move down spot on the couch and we're going to take a break and come back with Cecilia Estrich.
Perfect.
And we're going to bring everyone together.
Perfect.
That's cool.
Public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune into The Food Scene Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network. Hosted by Michael Harlan Turkel, photo editor of Edible Brooklyn and Edible Manhattan magazines, he'll further explore the amalgamation of food and art by talking to artists from a multitude of media. Guests will range from photographers, food stylists, interior architects for restaurants, industrial designers, all the players that make you want to eat with your eyes. Get ready to feast your ears. Every Tuesday at 3 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Exactly where we're going, I cannot say, but we might even
And we're back. Great segment, Maya Martinez.
Nice, that was nice. Carla, that intro was lot better than the last one.
It was. We didn't have
you're
like 20
songs. You're on the
songs.
Uphill.
Good work.
You're
good
on, work. In the right direction.
I didn't have to send Jack another text message, but it was fine.
Jack, come back. I have a feeling Jack is not very far. He's like right outside Roberta's.
I think he lives under this. Do they miss me? Yeah, exactly. We're going into our next guest, Cecilia Estridge. Just coming out of a song, Canned Heat, going to the country, which reminded me maybe of what you thought when you graduated from Vanderbilt. I was trying to find your way in the food world. Well, Cecilia Estridge is here. She's a graduate of Vanderbilt University. She started her food career working at a goat farm in West Palette, Vermont, Consider Bardwell. Then she moved back to her hometown of Manhattan, where she worked for various food blogs such as Flavor Pill and Behind the Burner. As a blogger, she followed local trending in food and sustainability. Enriching her passion for small farms, Cecilia decided to take a job in sales for a small company named Basis Farm to Chef. That company grew into a much larger entity, and supply and demand became an issue. After a two-year stint at Basis, she moved to her new home, Makuni Wild Harvest, a Canadian-based purveyor of specialty mushrooms, truffles, and other amazing products used by some of the top restaurants such as Danielle, and where we are currently broadcasting from Roberta's. Thank you for coming to the show, Cecilia Estridge.
Thank you for having me, Jason.
So to get right into it, talk a little bit about Makuni Wild Harvest for some of us who have no idea what that means.
So Makuni Wild Harvest is, as you said, specialty foods purveyor. We sell wild foraged foods primarily, so it's a lot of mushrooms. Right now we're doing Saskatchewan chanterelles, which are the most beautiful chanterelles in the universe. They're like teeny tiny.
Because they're smaller? I mean, I always hear most beautiful about every chanterelle. Why is this?
Are they farmed or are they wild?
No, they're wild. Mm-hmm. They're from British Columbia, and they look like cartoons. They're like exactly the same size. They're neon orange. They smell like apricots. They're
just waggy.
Just wacky. A lot of the stuff we sell is just wacky.
So when that comes, who's the first person? Like when you get a delivery like that, who's the first restaurant you call, or first three restaurants you call?
Polino is in the top 50
under
in
14th
New York
Street.
City in Manhattan.
No, I know maybe you don't want, but you're calling the top tier restaurants when you get a major delivery. Like
we
that,
are, right? Yeah, and I mean, all wild foods have a very finite season, and they tend to, and this is true of truffles, which I know that you'll want to know about next, but you know, they come onto the market really, really high at the beginning of the season. So often only the top 1% of restaurants can afford them. Then as the season gets going, the price drops and they sort of trickle down to all the other restaurants. And then the end of the season, the availability tightens up again and the price goes way up again. So
that's interesting. It's sort of on a different curve than most other sort of products.
Yeah, no, it's true.
Now, you're not really doing truffles, are you? I mean, I thought those only grew in like Spain and Italy and France.
And China.
And actually, truffles grow all over the world. Like right now we're selling Australian Perigord truffles, which most people associate with south of France. But they grow really well in Australia.
But can they be force grown, or it's just wherever they grow naturally?
People are trying to farm them now, I think, at like varying degrees of success. But they are a wild food, so they have also very specific seasons. But in Australia, the seasons are flip-flop, so it's winter right now, so they can grow what is, you know, a winter truffle.
Well, here comes our delivery. We're getting our delivery now of ice and sugar for our third segment. I just wanted to bring that up. But Cecilia, I feel for you, even though I'm on the other side of it, but I do feel for you guys, even though, and I think most chefs feel for the sales end of things, which is when you're day to day, when things get crazy, how do you stay positive in sales, especially when you're dealing with a lot of stressed out high-end restaurants and stuff?
And things that are so fleeting, you know, things that'll go bad so fast.
Well, I mean, it definitely is a stressful element of the job. The way that I stay positive is we're selling incredible things that are, you know, really difficult to source elsewhere. And we work with incredible farmers and foragers. And like, we work with this guy who calls himself Running Squirrel, who's a 75-year-old Cherokee Indian who's been harvests or foraging in Oregon for, you know, his entire life. He knows every edible plant in the woods. And like,
if you get named Running Squirrel as a Native American, you're like, I better become a forager.
No choice. But I think that's how I stay positive. But it can be stressful because, as you said, the product is fleeting. People want to have Saskatchewan chanterelles on their menu for 3 months. The season is 3 weeks.
And how? What's the average sale price? Like, you know, I sell, you know, meats, and so, you know, an average invoice might be $300-$400 for 50-60 pounds. I mean, this is just a few ounces, could be that much,
right? Which is one of the beautiful things about doing deliveries of this kind of stuff, because, you know, you've got three boxes, which could be $400, and each weighs 6 pounds or something. Mm-hmm. But definitely at Basis, it was the opposite. We sold our biggest items were milk and eggs, and so we had these truck drivers that hated us. You know, you'd have an invoice for $154 that was like 54 gallons of milk or something. It was the worst. But
when I first met you, you were at Basis, and you sort of had a lot of relationships out of that company and sort of branched out and did your sort of own thing, and then kind of brought a lot of these relationships to Makuni. But whether you're doing business with these things or not, it's just good. You sort of know what's going on entirely in the world of like smaller farms and stuff. Something Patrick deals a lot with in terms of proteins and stuff, but you see it more on the produce side. Anything like, do you constantly, like if you're dealing with a small farm, are you calling them all the time, or is this just
all
a relationship you have with them?
Yeah. When my partner Rachel Greenspan, who was actually on the show a while back with me, when we started at Makuni, she's also there now, we started a small local program that focuses, unlike Basis, more on sort of specialty produce and items that are a little more difficult to source. And we are working with farmers that we have not so much relationships with from Basis, but just from, you know, being around and like working at farmers markets and stuff. And we're on the phone with them constantly.
Do you demand exclusive rights to all of their farms?
We haven't up until this point demanded an exclusive from anyone, just because I don't think we're the program's at the level yet where it would be fair to ask that of anybody.
And do you work off handshake agreements or written contracts?
Handshake agreements so far.
Yeah, it's the same thing. I've always learned farmers do not believe in contracts. Right. Or they hold no weight. They'll sign it, but they don't care because they'll never get sued or allow you to sue. You'll never come onto their property to collect, so they'd shoot you, you know.
So. It's so true. We try to honor those handshake agreements. We pay people on 30-day terms. We try to sell as much of their product as possible and make it as convenient for them as possible. Because a lot of the time with small farms, it really is a convenience factor. You know, like, they don't have the logistical capabilities to run a truck down to the city. So we try to sort of like team them up so that only one guy has to run a truck down to the city.
And I'm sure you rely a lot on FedEx, right? Because it's such a light product and in small amounts.
Right. I mean, Makuni ships, I mean, we sell nationally, and we're, you know,
you have to have
number one customer of FedEx right now as a small business. We ship all over the place.
And do chefs call you, or do you have to call them?
This point, I feel fortunate that a lot of the time chefs call us. We have a really good reputation for,
And you guys send out an email and all that stuff.
Yeah. And we spam, as Jason can attest to.
But do you,
not spam.
Going back a little bit in your career, talk a little bit what it was like to work in the blog world, like Flavor Pill.
Flavor Pill.
Flavor Pill, I wasn't really writing about food so much. I was writing for the blog part of Flavor Pill, which is called Flavor Wire, which is, if you don't read it, it's awesome. It's got a lot of, you know, insightful and entertaining arts and culture coverage.
You'll find out what Gwyneth Paltrow ate for breakfast.
Gwyneth, forget it. She's in a yoga class cooking with Mario Batali and filming a movie, but it's a country movie, and she's singing in it right at the second.
You hooked me up with that table because I was staring at her. I would have had to look, like, hurt my neck to be staring at her.
Well, that was the first time I met you and Anne at the same time, who are the first couple of the slow food movement, and Patrick's mom, who's an amazing woman.
She was like, I don't like this.
And then I was like, yeah. Anytime you do a restaurant opening, everyone's like, you know, they'll always tell you something different. I'm like, oh, it's good. It's great. It's great. And Patrick's mom was like, I don't know how I feel about this.
This is a mistake.
Is this wrong?
I think she said you were a moron and that was a huge mistake.
If that was the best I got out of her, then I'll take it. But so Flavor Pill, and then, you know, I know Behind the Burner a little bit because they do like sort of video quick, like, there's a young woman that works on there, and she does like
Divya.
Yeah, Divya. Yeah.
She is a very energetic woman. She's all over.
Yeah,
the
she
place
did like we were doing Taste of Tribeca when I worked at Tribeca Grill, and she did three changes, like three dress changes.
It's like the Oscars.
Yeah, it was like she was walking around, and then they're like, "Can I do a thing with the chef?" And I was like, "Yeah, sure, come back." And then she had changed again and changed again, which was like kind of wacky. But when you left Vanderbilt and you worked at the Gopher, what were you doing? What are you doing at Gopher? Is this sort of like some romantic kind of thing, or are you actually in the dirt and stuff?
Well, I actually, when I graduated from college, worked for a really high pressure event planning company for a year.
Okay,
and it was an incredible company. They did events for arts organizations mostly, but I burned out hardcore after a year of it, and I knew the people who owned Consider Bardwell, and then passing, they'd been like, oh, yeah, you're interested in food. You should come out. You should, you know, work on the farm. We'll put you up.
This is a great dairy farm, great goat dairy farm. And she's also a publisher, so she's super well connected. So it's a very large, well-funded, successful business.
Mm-hmm. And they have a really cool cheesemaker who is really well-respected all over the United States. He consults on projects.
Is Anne selling any of this stuff?
Yeah, she sells it. She's the one that, Anne is the one that came up with this idea for No Goat Left Behind, this project that we're launching in the month of Goat-tober. And basically, it's this real thing that she was the first person we met, Consider Bardwell. The lady from there, and she was like, I have all these bucklings that I don't know what to do with because I'm a dairy farm and I have no use for male goats other than as breeders. So we agreed to buy basically all of her goats and all the goats of some other neighboring dairy farms. So right now we have to move like 700 goats in Goat-tober. So thank God Polino's is in for 12 head a week.
No comment. Interesting. So wait, when you're up there, what are you doing when you're up there? When you're in sort of like the groove of it, you wake up 6 a.m. There's some, you know, rooster going off or something, and what happens?
Yeah, actually, there was a rooster, and it was a nasty rooster. And I hear recently they killed it and turned it into coq au vin. So,
oh really?
Actually, the first time coq au vin in the U.S. was properly made with an old rooster.
It's supposed to be.
Is that really what it's supposed to be?
Exactly. It's like traditionally it should be made with the old rooster on the land. Yeah.
I didn't know what I was getting into at all, and I did have sort of like a Marie Antoinette-ish like romantic idea of what it meant to work on a farm, and I got there, and it was the most grueling work I've ever done in my life. We would wake up at like 4:45, 5 o'clock in the morning, and I didn't do any of the animal care at all. I just did cheese making, and as like the new intern, I would like haul these milk cans off the back of a pickup truck when they dropped them off in the morning, because it was they do their own goat milk, but they also work with a cow dairy farm down the street called I think Jersey Girls, and so they would deliver these milk cans.
Maybe like carrying them upstairs like Uma Thurman in Kill Bill 2.
Beast them up. No, you'd have to like roll them because they were too heavy to pick up, and you dump them all into the pasteurization vat. And then when I started, was not advanced enough to do any of the actual cheese making, so I would spend like 2 hours in the morning just scrubbing out all the milk cans and like cleaning all the cheese molds. And then I would go into the aging caves and I would you know, wash all the rinds, and that also was like intense physical labor.
We hear that word a lot thrown around, whether you're buying cheese instead of an artisanal cheese store. Washed rinds, like, what is that? Are you washing it with a sponge? Are you washing it with your hands? Or washed rinds? What are you washing it with? Ash? I mean, like, you hear that. What does that mean,
well,
actually?
So you wash the rinds, if it's a washed rind cheese, with certain solutions. Like, people do it with beer. We're actually launching a cheese at Makuni in collaboration with Andante Creamery, which is in the Napa Valley. And she's doing, we make this awesome, awesome bourbon barrel aged maple syrup.
It is.
And so she's washing the rind with that. But it fosters, I think, growth of different bacteria and stuff that gives it a different
colors.
Protect the cheese.
And, yeah.
I have, by the way, thought of, and I'm sorry to be blowing my own horn right here.
It's okay.
But I had forever been looking for a name of that little piece of the strip of the cheese that's between the rind and the actual cheese, and it has this little melty zone.
It's called
it's
called a Flugelbinder.
Ah, yes.
Is it really?
No, that's actually the piece of plastic on shoelaces.
Oh. Well, that was good.
It sounded like it would work.
Way to upstage my story. I don't know but anyway, if I was rich, I would just order that section of the cheese and make them throw out all the rest. But I finally thought of the name, and I've been asking. It's the Plage du Fromage.
The Plage du Fromage?
The beach of the cheese.
That's great.
Because it's neither one, neither land nor water. Neither rind nor cheese. It's a very thin strip. Plage de fromage.
Did Anne teach you that at Pillow Talk or something?
No, but I'm very proud of that. Plage de fromage. I think it should start being used. It's officially trademarked with today's date, thanks to Carlos. Where's Carlos? No, just kidding.
Carlos is back there. He's on, I don't know if he's on, I think he's on J-Date, or I can't make that out, or I can't figure it out.
Are you on J-Date, Carlos Saguaro?
I see a computer screen.
That's illegal.
I can't make it up.
With a washed rind, cheese.
Sorry,
you don't actually have the plage de fromage, right?
Oh, right,
because
right.
Yeah, because with the washed rind, that's the whole thing with it. It's
right.
You know, aging really, really uniformly.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things about washing that's really nice, is that you can have this beautifully kind of
whole. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maya, where are you procuring your stuff from these days anyway?
Oh, cheese. I don't want to talk about that.
Okay.
cheese in a can.
Fair enough.
It's a love hate. It's difficult. Yeah.
Especially when you're a smaller sort of company and stuff like that. So. But Cecilia, when now you sort of your schedule, are you working out of the office, or I know you've been around long enough that you sort of have relationships, but are you still going to new restaurants and hitting the pavement?
Always. Right now we're focusing on restaurants outside of New York, but on the East Coast. I mean, as I said before, Mukuni sells all over the country, but because we're West Coast based, haven't gotten much traction sort of in other cities. Like
any culinary East Coast things that we're not talking about right now? I know
any
I
big
Atlanta.
Cities that we should be
I know Atlanta. I hear Atlanta,
Portland
Atlanta.
Recently.
Oh, Portland, and I know Portland, Maine. Oh, like, don't let me start on that.
Awesome,
I love
awesome
Portland, Maine.
Food scene. But
amazing food scene, and I think that they have sorry Patrick, what are you
can you name one great restaurant in Vermont?
In Vermont, no, but there's a great diner in on Route 7 in...
But wait a second, it's interesting. A state like Vermont, made in Vermont, Vermont's number one. You know, you put Vermont on a product that people sell.
The Keene Diner. The Keene Diner.
Restaurant.
Someone was telling me the other day about a really good restaurant in Vermont. Now I can't remember what it was called.
But anyway, there's not one. I mean, in San Francisco, you say Chez Panisse. Yeah. You know, in L.A. you can say, you know, Moza, or there's always a name of a restaurant that people would consider. In Vermont, it's just so unusual that there's not one
thing that pops
nationally
up.
Or even regionally known restaurant.
But I know of the Keene Diner, which I'm pretty sure is...
Is this the diner that's like everything is from Vermont? And
probably. It's just a great spot, I think, off Route 7 or whatever. It's kind of like New York kind of thing. But you're talking about Portland, Maine, which is an amazing culinary place that doesn't get any respect
there's a New York Times article, I think, recently.
But there's an amazing procurement that comes out of, for example, Danielle gets a lot of his seafood from not the name of the company,
Brown
Trading. Yeah. Thank you for saving me there. Brown Trading Company, like basically all of Danielle's higher end restaurants, I think, procures out of there. But it's interesting, all these great cities that we don't, you know, we hear about and stuff, but are doing amazing things in food. But anyway, I'd like to thank Cecilia for
she's
going to
stay on, but we're going to go to the best part of the show which involves absinthe.
There's a bottle of absinthe here. There's some contraption which either we're smoking opium out of or something. I don't know. But
take
I think
a 2-second break, and that's not an exaggeration, and we will come back and drink absinthe.
Great.
With Nastasia.
With the shadow still remains since your descent.
We are back on the main course, hosted by Jason Colucci.
Oh.
And I'm Patrick Martins. Our next guest is Natasha David, a traveling bard, if you will. But rather than serving up elaborate poems from place to place, she is serving up elaborate cocktails. Emerging out of the nationwide mixology craze in New York City, she has pressed on and has worked at some premier spots such as Van Dag, Pulino's, Fatty Johnson's, Maialino, Woodson and Ford, and Dram, etc., etc. She is currently working at Maison Premier, which I've been to, I think is a great place, a throwback to a New Orleans-inspired absinthe house. When times were simpler. Where did you get that? When times were simpler.
But the cocktails weren't.
Talk about how you have seen... Okay, wait. This is already a question.
And also a graduate of New York University, which I did not put in there. But no, I put... can I just say, I wrote that intro. I was streamlining like a Charlie Rose interview, et cetera.
That was very romantic. Were you looking at pictures of Natasha on Facebook or something? And
I hope you don't have that thing where you can check and see how many times I've been on your Facebook.
Yeah, exactly. I always wonder that.
Now, Jason and I have a very romantic relationship.
Yeah, I always come to the place she works at for 3 months, and then she goes somewhere else.
Well, yes, you have worked at many great places. So tell us a little bit about that. I mean, jumping from place to place, what was your intention? Would you just want to learn something? Or
yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm always trying to learn more. And I feel like the more and more I'm doing what I'm doing, the more and more I realize how little I know. Because every place I go to, every day I learn about a new product, I learn about a new way of distilling, I learn about, you know, it's endless. So yeah, I'm always trying to find
new places. Let's just do a real quick what's it called, rapid fire. I'm going to name the place.
So right now Patrick is turning off the knob for this absinthe.
We're dripping absinthe
over,
it might be broken.
So you have to do cold water over the sugar.
Yeah, over the sugar cube. Okay.
And then how much, like, for a pour, like, for example, if you were doing a serving,
yeah,
it'd be a 1 ounce absinthe pour?
Yeah, like an ounce and a quarter, and then you do four to five parts of water.
The cold water melts the sugar, and it sort of balances it out. And I had one of these on Friday, and they're amazing, but if you're going to have one or two, please, proceed with caution afterwards.
What's the difference between this absinthe and the famous absinthe that people hear about and read about in books from France?
Well, you know, this whole absinthe is actually a beautiful, beautiful thing, and there's such a ceremony behind it, and there's such a ceremony behind serving it, which I love. And it just got a really bad rap, and you know, wormwood is what gave it this bad reputation, and wormwood has been used for medicinal purposes for like thousands of years.
Does wormwood get a bad reputation?
Well, there's a chemical compound in wormwood called thorjune, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, they sort of blamed a bunch of hallucinations onto it.
Well, then,
crazy people doing crazy things.
Oh,
and
what's so crazy?
Writing crazy poetry, introduction.
Abex. Cubism. I mean, what's so crazy about that?
Yeah, that's true.
But like, you know, like I said to any, like I say this to customers all the time, like if you drink enough of anything, like you're going to see green fairies. So especially if you're drinking an overproof spirit. So
what draws you to absinthe as a drink? Like this beautiful, what is this tool called?
Absinthe fountain, okay, or an absinthe drip.
It's like a spigot. It has two spigots.
It's a little faucet.
Is this something that we can sort of pour? Is this ready to go?
Yeah. Okay, somebody drank that.
Please, oh, yeah. So what
we're drinking a beautiful absinthe from California.
Let me serve
St. George.
St. George. Okay. And is St. You had mentioned, I was there on
just
Friday
yeah.
to try it out. And you had mentioned St. George is one of your favorite.
Yeah. St. George is one of my favorite absinthes. It's like, it's one of those like really thick, murky, dirty, dirty absinthes. And I love that.
And there's like, you guys have like, I think, 14 or 15.
No, we're up to we're up to like 30 absinthes, maybe. We have the largest selection of absinthe in the country right now, which is super exciting.
And is that a most popular thing when people going in because they're trying to get?
Yeah, I think people are. You know, there's so much mystery surrounding absinthe. That's absinthe, everyone. That people get really excited, and you know.
Jason, you have little pink elephants coming out of your ear.
I hope so. It wouldn't be a Sunday if it wasn't.
Well, this is very interesting. Let's do rapid fire real quick. I'm going to name the bar, and you say what you most learned there or the most inspiring thing.
Okay.
Polino's.
I ate a lot of great pizza, and I met Jason.
Van Dag. Okay, that had nothing to do with the cocktail culture, but whatever. Van Dag.
Geneva Gin and Aquavit. Never worked with those spirits before. That's what they focus on. It was fantastic.
Fatty Johnson's.
Well, Fatty Johnson was just like a pop-up restaurant that I guess bartended at. And I got to just like make my own cocktails, which was super fun.
Maialino?
Italian spirits.
Oh, very nice. So like Amaro's
Amaro's, Grappa's.
Woodson and Ford?
That was my first cocktail bar. So that was like the mecca of it all.
So
I learned like all my foundation there.
And how long does it take to make a good cocktail? I mean, it takes a few minutes. I think people don't realize.
Yeah, absolutely. We brought this up when I was there on Friday, which was a lot of people, I feel like, in other restaurants just come up with a name first and then work the cocktail under the name. They'll come up with a really witty name. And I had asked you how long it took to workshop a lot of those cocktails there. And it was like, no, these are like,
I mean, you know, it's crazy to think how much money a place has to put into curating a cocktail menu, because the amount of times you have to try a drink over and over again to make it, you know, perfect is outrageous. So I see a lot of places being very smart now and just doing classics because they're already established, they're great, and you don't have to like spend all that money.
Tell us about Dram, and then I have a question about I like Dram very much.
Yeah, Dram is another place I just guest bartend at. My husband actually bartends there. I'm married to a bartender.
Second year anniversary, by the way.
Yeah, it's our second year anniversary this year.
Mazel tov.
Thank you very much. Dram is a really amazing bar. It's a totally bartender driven bar, where you know, whereas you go to a lot of places and you're like told to make your Negroni a certain way, they kind of trust you there, and they know that the people they've hired, whatever their spec is, like that Negroni is going to be good. So
does that create? I've seen this before, this style before, but does that create friction between each bartender when they come in and their station's completely set up?
The station is the same.
Okay, station is the same.
But the station will be the same.
So how would you divide the cocktails? Like, let's say someone was. Someone is on sabbatical. Like, I think in Australia, they let people out for 6 months after 10 years of working. And some people New York. So you get 6 months off, and they're like, we want to learn all about the cocktail culture that kind of exists in New York. How would you basically break down that paradigm? Like, what are the pillars? Like, is there the fresh farmer's market cocktail or the snooty hoity-toity cocktail? Like, what are the general families, major
families? Yeah, absolutely.
Families?
I mean, you know... Here's the thing. I feel like cocktail culture in New York is like getting a really bad rap.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is, you know, there was kind of a time where there were all these kind of snooty bartenders with attitudes. And I think that's really changing, thank God. And I think there's sort of a return to service finally. So I think now anybody can go and enjoy a really great cocktail. But yeah, there's definitely, there's like the classic cocktail. Like, you know...
The Cosmo. I remember working as a kid in the restaurant industry, and I remember Swingers came out, and there was this whole Cocktail Nation thing that had happened. But that was more sort of Cosmo and Martini and stuff.
Yeah, you know, this is kind of... What's happening right now is, like, this resurgence of... You know, I don't really like using these terms, but of, like, pre-Prohibition era cocktails. Sort of going completely away from the Cosmos and the pre-made sour mix and things like that.
To what?
To, you know, really awesome quality ingredients, to handmade syrups and, you know, and I think it kind of goes hand in hand with the whole slow food movement, because customers now are savvy.
Yeah.
And they don't want to just drink crap. They don't want to, you know, the thing that I always found so shocking that one day I found this out was that, you know, a lot of places have like, tequila in their rail that isn't even tequila. It's just flavored. It's like a base grain spirit, and they flavor it with tequila flavoring. That is so awful to me.
Seems like it would cost just as much.
And it's a little bit cheaper, but you're 100% right. It's the thing that gives you
And that's when you get a hangover.
Yeah,
like,
that's
you know, you
have
like a bad college story of, I can never drink tequila again.
Yeah, yeah.
It's because you drank that crap.
You know, that's interesting.
Like, makes you sick.
And it comes across, and you're right, because it comes across as being, like, you go to a place and they have sort of well stuff and then some other stuff, and you come across as being like a snob. You're like, no, I just don't want to drink.
Yeah.
I just want to drink. I don't want to have a headache the next day.
Is tequila a lesser drink in terms of the bartender's, you know, menu?
No.
But like,
tequila,
vodka
beautiful.
Is.
Well, listen, the reason we don't use vodka that much, the idea behind cocktails is you're building flavors on top of flavors.
And vodka has no flavor.
A vodka, by law, is a flavorless, odorless spirit. So it's not that we necessarily don't like vodka. It's just that we don't use it because it doesn't really enhance a drink in any way, shape, or form.
And what is a proper, let's say someone doesn't know the what cocktail they want, but what is the right way of asking that to a bartender? It's just giving your preferential alcohol.
Yeah, I mean,
whiskey and
like
juice?
The one, you know, and people will do this all the time, but you know, people just walk in and they're like, make me your favorite drink. And you're like, well, like, that's like,
you
that's
have to
really,
name a
yeah,
liquor,
like,
right?
that's really silly because
but
I'm going
to. What else do you name?
I mean, I always ask for a base spirit, and then I ask for whether they want it shaken or stirred. And I always, you know, I'm like, shaken is going to have citrus, and it's going to be light and refreshing, and stirred is going to be boozy and like a, you know, Manhattan or something like that.
Well, I saved my receipt from when I was here on Friday.
You need
just,
your own network, your own show.
I feel like there's a lot of like open liquors on there.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to. I know I figured as much of whatever, but I just wanted to go over a couple of things because I know one of your favorite spirits is rum.
I love rum.
Okay. What was in the Ron Zacava drink I had? I see in here.
Oh, I made you two Ron Zacava drinks.
Okay, cool.
I made, because you got free stuff.
Okay, I didn't want to say that.
It's not on the check.
Yeah, I knew that, but...
It's okay. It's totally legal.
Okay, cool.
My mother's the only one listening, by the way, to this show.
And my mom too. What's absinthe? Sorry.
The first drink I made you, and this was kind of the first drink I realized how beautiful rum was, because I had those bad college stories of drinking rum and feeling really sick the next day. Is I made you a rum Manhattan.
Oh, really?
So it was super simple. It was just the 23-year-old Ron Zacapa. It was Antica sweet vermouth and orange bitters.
Awesome. That was really simple.
And yeah, you know, that's another thing. Like, everyone thinks these drinks are so complicated, and they see us, like, you know, doing all these things that they think are really complicated. It's actually, like, it's really simple.
Yeah.
We're just using a bunch of really simple ingredients and mixing them together in a right way. So there's not, like, brain surgery behind this.
So can you speak a little bit before we get, because you did bring in another alcohol, right? I see.
I brought in some Havana Club.
Oh my God!
Is this allowed? Is this like kind of bringing in Cohibas in here? Is this allowed?
This is allowed. In this network,
allowed.
It is. So, can you speak a little bit to the theater of the bar, the stage, and the actors? And you're like one of the chief actors.
Yeah.
How do you interact with people 5 minutes before you're going to get around to them? As you're getting around to them after, talk about kind of etiquette, culture of bars. Of good bars.
Well, obviously, you know, there is a lot, you know, you are performing and the bar kind of is a stage and there is a lot, you know, like I said about absinthe, there's this whole like showmanship and this whole, you know, ceremony that goes along with it. And I find that, I mean, that's probably the most sort of entertaining part of it. And people, you know, people love to watch this stuff. People love to come and sit and watch everything that you're doing. And, you know, I think especially with, you know, a lot of people are sort of intimidated by the kind of drinks that we serve at Maison. So it's about, I think, you know, relating things to the customer and making them feel comfortable and not feel like they're like out of their league or something like that.
But that environment is totally perfect. Like from a restaurant procurement geek walking in there and seeing what they have, the infrastructure they have, for example, like, the tools she's working with, you almost have to go on eBay to buy the stuff that you're working on, or be a serious antiquer.
We're super lucky. Like, we have great tools.
Be like a serious antiquer in the South or something, because everything you use, I didn't see The only sort of thing I found was the receipt at the end that was sort of a like modern kind of thing. And that's why I saved it, because everything from the tools you were working with the bar were procured. I mean, and probably aren't easy to find. So how do you, is that cool? Kind of that makes the whole mystique of the sort of theater.
Yeah, I mean, especially at Maison Premiere, it is such an experience, because the idea was to be transported into this completely different world and to make you feel like you're, you know, and
in the 20s.
Yeah, like the sort of turn of the century, New Orleans, you know, there's a lot of French influence as well. But I think something that's really awesome about Maison is that, yeah, there's, you know, all this great decor and it's all these great products, but it's super accessible. And I think we have all these sort of luxury products like oysters and things like that. And when we do this thing, like we do a dollar happy hour of all of 15 different oysters, and it becomes this accessible thing.
So back to the theater aspect, is it the customer, like for instance, I walk in there, you know, just for success like this with my radio t-shirt. Is it my job to make eye contact and get some connection to the bartender, or are you always 100% have ordered everyone when they come? Like, can I trust that I will be served right before him and right after
trust.
That guy?
You can trust. And that, absolutely.
And even though you don't make eye contact with me.
I mean, I think I hope I make eye contact with you. I like to acknowledge people and let them know I'm aware that they're there.
Because a lot of
bars
don't.
I mean, my biggest pet peeve, I don't wave money in my face.
No, I see
that you're there. Like,
hard thing because, you know, you're waiting in line, you have a girl, you're wanting to buy her a drink,
absolutely.
You don't want to wait 15 minutes.
Especially
but then
for, like, these
kind of
drinks.
That.
Like, obviously, I'm going to spend, like, by the time I get to you, it might be maybe a little longer than you're used to waiting. I understand that. So that's why I think, actually, it's very important to acknowledge a customer.
What is the ideal time to wait to get a drink? Because I've heard some people, like Jason Denton, who was on last week, is like, if they wait more than 5 minutes, they're going to be a little upset.
Yeah, no, 5 minutes is no good.
Because you guys do
after
it, it's like an art
after
piece.
They order from you?
After they order from me.
Yeah, I don't think anything. I mean, we ordered three cocktails and at a time.
But people wait long times for drinks because as much thought and almost time is put into a drink as a chef making a dish in the kitchen. But at the same time, how do you account for the fact that someone might wait 25 minutes for a drink?
I also hope that people understand. I mean, this goes two ways. I hope that when a customer comes to Maison or any kind of, you know, any of these cocktail bars, that they're kind of aware of where they're going and understand what
I'm
doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if you're really thirsty, just ask for a beer and a cocktail, and like I'll give you the beer right away, and then you'll get your cocktail. I mean,
can I get a
really
shot of your favorite liquor?
I really don't think they take that long.
No, it doesn't take a long time, but it is an interesting thing because I'd always remember Jason Denton. More than 5 minutes, that person after the whole day is just like, I need a drink in me. You know?
No, he's absolutely. Jason was 100% right, but it's exactly about like the place you walk in and how educated the customer is. And customers are really educated, especially in Manhattan, and especially if they're in Williamsburg and going to Maison Premiere. When I walked in there, I didn't expect to. It was a busy place. It was Friday night. I didn't expect.
Oh my God, that
to,
was the busiest night we've ever had.
Really? Less
oh
that
God,
night?
It was crazy.
Packed. I didn't expect.
My hands are still.
I didn't expect to get anything, and I was just kind of laid back. I was like, I'm here, whatever. And then just serendipitously, a spot opened, and we sat at the bar, and we got our drinks. But I think it's a lot of the restaurateurs or the bartenders educating the public, and then the public sort of like feeding back off of that, and walking into a place and realizing that hey, it's not going to happen right away. That's the whole reason why I'm here. Cecilia, do you agree with any? Do you like when you go on a date or something, or you're your boyfriend?
Are you asking Cecilia out? Is this going to be all long circuitous?
No, Cecilia has Cecilia is in a serious relationship, and your boyfriend's a chef. Where is he working now? I don't know if you could talk about that. I don't know.
He's actually working at Brooklyn Brine right now.
Is Brooklyn spelled correctly, or is it spelled one of these really weird ways?
Like the old Dutch way.
Brooklyn.
Yeah. Oh, no, the Dutch. Oh, the Dutch. It's like, oh, is it Brooklyn or is it not? It's like, it's my lawyer will decide if we're Brooklyn or Brooklyn.
It's trademarked.
But no, when you walk in, when you first started dating your boyfriend, you guys went to a place like that was like his choice, like... It wasn't. What are you getting a drink or something? What are your thoughts like if you're waiting for a cocktail for a long time?
Well, I mean, I don't think any cost. I think Jason Denton was probably right.
You worked at Eno for a year.
I did work at Eno for a year. Service was always excellent.
Yeah.
No, actually, the
But he's also not trying to blow people's mind, as he says about his cuisine, whereas the Maison Premier within the cocktail world is trying to blow your mind, so you need time for that.
Yeah, I think that that's important, like, yeah, what your expectations are. If you're coming for an excellent, well-crafted cocktail and you understand the sort of...
But I also think customers, like, they can see us working.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And they know, like... I'm not just standing there, like, twiddling my thumb, like, talking to my coworker.
Yeah.
I'm, like, I'm in the weeds, and I'm making you a lot of, I'm making a lot of drinks, and I'm you know, double straining, and I'm pre-shaking, and I'm doing all these things. Like, they see I'm busy, and I think customers are very understanding.
And their beer taps almost have these, like, sort of, they have scales under the beer taps. I almost think, like, in, like, oh, do you know what I said? Do you guys weigh the amount of waste at the end of the day? I don't. Dude, what are those? Just catches for? Yeah. Just catches.
Yeah.
They almost,
yeah.
It looks like an old.
Yeah. You know, they're old.
Triple beam balance.
What are they? Or, old stove burners.
So I have a question. If I looked at, Heritage Food sells to 80 restaurants around the city, and I would say 70 to 80% of them, the bell curve, are doing similar things based off of the season. Doing similar things with the same products or even different products, you know, like there could be frisée salads in the summer and all that. Is there commonality between different cocktail houses at certain times of the year, or when you look at the established menu, is it completely random and what's important to the bartender?
I mean, I think we all sort of have certain things in common. I think it's always funny when there's like a new product that comes out and suddenly every single cocktail bar has a cocktail with it. You know?
But is there commonalities mostly or mostly not?
I think, yeah, absolutely, because they all kind of share, you know, their, what is this, the root of it all is the same.
And what is
we
that
all
based
carry
on?
The same
season
products.
Or based off of classic cocktails?
I think New York isn't as like seasonally driven.
Mm-hmm.
I think like the cocktail scene in San Francisco, things like in, or in LA, those are very like they have all these great products available. So it's much more food driven and herb driven and vegetable driven and things like that. I think here it's much more spirits-driven.
Do you want a beet martini?
Yeah, exactly.
Are there any drinks you will not make? And my other question is, what percentage of the cocktails ordered are from the menu?
I would say most.
Most, yeah.
Yeah,
it's a
absolutely.
Think of that. Most people don't go off the menu. Just like same with pizzas. Whatever pizzas you name, very few people are like, I want the marg with sausage and onions. Like, they'll get one of the complicated
ones. But people
ones.
Also like, you know, something that is exciting about having a bunch of really great bartenders behind a bar is that they have an encyclopedia of drinks that is really large.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can also, and, you know, so you can come in and order all kinds of wacky classics, but you can also, like, do a bunch of bartender's choices. Like, we kind of get off on coming up with weird new concoctions for you, so.
Mm-hmm. And you guys have an array of. I buy liquor, and I've some of the things.
Our back bar is
some
crazy.
Of the thing I've never seen.
Yeah,
I've
it's
never
amazing.
Seen. I mean, it almost seemed like a like really small producer somewhere.
Yeah,
and
we have amazing relationships. And
well, you were saying, Jason, it was one of your favorite bar. Top seven bar experiences that week. So I mean, that
well,
was pretty.
Yeah, it was. No, I did. Say,
to
I did.
Two
who,
a
is
night,
the,
though.
Who is the who is the owner that I met?
Josh Boise.
And I said to him, it was the most exciting opening. When did you guys? What year? Was it
this year?
Yeah, this year. I said it was the most.
You got no, right.
No, I said it was the most exciting opening of the year, even though you guys are doing like sort of limited food. You're doing oysters. By the way, Patrick, the gentleman that procures the oysters, because Patrick loves operations and stuff, his job alone seems insane because he's buying 50 different things sort of from all over the country. But I said it was one of the most – it's just fun. Like just it talked about places and I had an amazing time. But before we go to break, I'm going to stand up. And can you please talk me through making – a proper absence. So
and
I
then, by the
yes.
way, when we come back from break, we're going to play a restaurant game that Jason conceived where you guys can design your own restaurant. We'll find out what's similar, what's different. So,
okay,
but
cool.
let's take
stand,
us
let me
to
stand,
break.
Let me,
with
let me stand up here and then you can talk
okay.
me through.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, so first thing.
Talk about performance studies right here, theater studies.
So pour some water into the top of that absinthe fountain.
When you say absinthe fountain, what does it look like?
It's like a little, it's like, it has like two little, it's like a little sink with two little faucets.
It's like
and
old
it's
school
kind of,
faucets.
Yeah.
With the hot
Yeah,
the
that's
cold.
Good. That's good. Now let's get a glass. Let's get a fresh glass.
Fresh and, glass.
Here, use this glass one. That looks fresh.
Don't you know that you don't want absinthe touching plastic?
And then pour like an ounce of absinthe in there.
Just an ounce?
Yeah. Okay. It's overproof.
Just an ounce.
No, no, not in there, not in there. In the glass, in the glass. That looks good. That look. Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. Mm,
God. Easy there, oh, buddy. God.
We will be seeing fairies. Now take your spoon, your absinthe spoon.
She also looks like an opium spoon.
Okay. So, no. Put it, like, lengthwise across the glass. And then you see where the water is dripping down? Put your sugar cube there.
For all our listeners, don't do what Jason just did.
And now you're diluting the sugar into the absinthe. So and you see that cool, like, that color that's changing there? That's called the louche. That's all the, like, the chlorophyll from all the different herbs is making that happen. So this is all totally natural.
It's kind of the same color as the plage de fromage.
Yeah, the louche.
And then I'm turning this sink off?
Not yet, because you just added, like, 4 ounces of absinthe. Okay, so we're going to let the water drip for a while.
Yeah.
Unless, you know.
No, I'm just wondering.
I will be... Cool. Manning the last segment of the show, I can tell. Okay. With that pour.
I will not be drinking.
I will.
Okay, perfect. You want
to? Well, I did learn, talking about all this cool French stuff, I did learn the French word for rhombus last night, and it's loisange. Loisange. For you, Carlos, it's spelled the way it sounds. Loisange. All right, well, we are going to take a break and also maybe talk some taste things about this absinthe and find out how each of these three ladies would design their own restaurant.
Perfect.
Because it is survival of the fittest. When the beat hits the fan, I got my shank in my hand. Black man with the permanent tan. I come from the villain, never ran. Damn, I'm feeling another part of reality. Hit me when I represent the FAP. Straight from the hills, hill, didn't play the building. I mean literally when I say I make a killing. For my cypher, see I'm feeling the Busta pipe. Original heads represent the Brooklyn all night. Do or die, I'm saying this, you or not. Bring your click, it's the beat that gets stone like family sly. Need to see I in the bush. Biting the team, rocking the rock, giving the push. We did it like that and now we do it like this. We did it like that and now we do it like this. Go inside your mind and find a time that you miss. And just think about the steel in your fist. It's just an extension of your arm. It's that ghetto type of charm that makes all the homeboys swarm. Can I drop the bomb? Oh yes I can. Move with the groove, smooth like Geechee Dan. Who is the man? That kid there. Who is the chick with the pick in her hair? Angela or Davis? And we roll like Avis. Rent a car, kid, there you are. You know where to find me whenever you need me. If you know the app, follow the path to the land of the aftermath. But don't frolic in the midst. Praise the Brooklyn kids, cause they always throwing a body on my lawn. I'm getting a rock voila without a collar.
See, it shouldn't be my eyes. Just drink it like that.
Wow, I'm all over. Yeah, I'm all over the place. Is that?
I mean, you can put it over.
Am I supposed to see?
That was me drinking absinthe.
Oh, whoa! I don't know about this, but I feel like. Does anybody have any oil paint and a canvas around? I feel like.
So we have 18 minutes. 18 minutes. Favorite. Okay, just start.
All right.
Cecilia answers first. What's the question?
Cecilia, yeah. Dream restaurant, dream city. Where would you do it?
Well, talk real close.
Forgot about that one. If I were to open a restaurant, I mean, I would open it in New York. I'm a native New Yorker, so
where
I feel like.
Where did you go to high school?
She's
Berkeley Carroll in Park
Slope.
Yeah.
I went to Browning.
No way.
I hit a home run off of your pitcher, bottom of the ninth inning, to take us into the playoffs.
I
so it was like 11th grade.
Privileged stories.
We had a
stories.
Pretty serious baseball team
I
at Berkeley
know.
Carroll.
That's what made my hit all the more impressive.
Well,
this was 1986, of course.
86, he had his Mets hat on, his Daryl Strawberry jersey on.
All right, so big restaurant.
So big restaurant. I want to preface this by saying that it is like my worst nightmare would be to open a 200 seat restaurant.
Okay,
but
in Manhattan,
not in Manhattan. I think I would open it in Brooklyn.
What
I feel a little bit like
what neighborhood? This
neighborhood.
Is quickfire.
Sorry, I think I'd do it in my neighborhood in Prospect Heights.
All right.
Well, wait. Okay, next.
Now, big restaurant. What part of the country? What city? What food? What cuisine? You have to fill up a lot of seats.
Do you know, again, I share that sentiment. I definitely would not want to open anything big. To me, that seems just unwieldy.
City.
City. Do you know, I love Brooklyn. I've been here for 15 years, and I'm originally from California, and I really, really love this place. I like the people. I like the
Carroll Gardens,
way that people
Carroll
eat.
Carroll Gardens?
I don't know. I don't know exactly where in Brooklyn, but somewhere maybe.
So that means we get to choose a neighborhood for you. Coney Island.
Okay. No. Natasha, neighborhood.
Bushwick.
Oh,
Bushwick.
Yeah.
By the way, this segment is called Let's Talk Brooklyn. Yes.
Let's Talk Brooklyn. Let's talk. You would open a big restaurant in Bushwick.
I would open a big restaurant in Bushwick, and I would serve steaks and oysters.
Oh, nice. All like right. A kind of Peter Luger done, you know, from regular people.
A quick name. Yeah. A name. Okay. A name of it. Something that comes to your head quick.
Steak and Oysters Bar.
Okay. Now we'll stay here, and then we'll go that way. Ideal date restaurant and ideal breakup restaurant in the five boroughs.
Ooh, best date restaurant, Pine Meats, for sure.
Oh.
Because I like to eat meat on a date. Oh, God, that sounded really bad. Breakup restaurant.
Frankie's.
Oh, God.
Cafe Peddler.
Something with no chairs.
A Chinese takeout restaurant, like China One.
Wohop at 6 a.m.
In front of Panda, the $6.99 photo of Mushu Pork.
Mayo up. Date restaurant.
I'm totally unprepared. I don't go on dates.
Are you married?
I'm not.
But you don't date.
Yeah, dates in big restaurants. They scare me.
Oh, date in a restaurant.
You know, I don't know. There's a plethora of restaurants to go on dates in Brooklyn.
Pick for
again,
you. Mile End.
Super romantic. You know what?
That wouldn't be a bad place.
I do love Mile End.
Yeah.
I love a little schmaltz. And on a date, it's probably necessary.
It makes me too nostalgic about my boobie. So
Sammy's Romanian Steakhouse.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So, wait, for a first date or a breakup? Because I don't want to be spending $200 from dumping
too much money to spend on the breakup.
And almost too much money for a first date as well. It almost cancels themselves out.
Yeah.
Just, yeah. 20th anniversary. Right?
So,
of course, if it were a breakup, that keyboard player would definitely make me feel okay.
Yes. He would.
And on a first date, if it works out, I don't think I want that T-shirt reminder 3 years later of our first date.
So,
date.
First date.
I love Il Buco.
Where was the first date you went on with your boyfriend?
Well, Il Buco lost Ignacio, but then they gained Christopher Lee.
Where's your boyfriend now? Where's the first date you guys had?
Kajitsu, actually.
Okay.
And
so where
Buddhist
are you,
Japanese restaurant?
And where are you thinking about?
Sounds gastronomically cool. Awesome.
Where are you thinking about dumping him?
When I think gastronomy, I think Buddhism and Amish.
Oh, you're still going? I'm sorry.
Favorite Keith McNally restaurant and least favorite Keith McNally restaurant. No, they're all
into
great.
The fire pit.
I'll say it quick. My favorite and my really favorite is Balthazar and Mineta Tavern. Those are my two.
And if you had to least, what would be the one that would just be the last? Pravda?
Well, one that is he doesn't own anymore, which is the Odeon.
Okay, smart good. Answer. Smart. Nice. Does he own Lucky Strike?
Yes.
Is the food good there?
I have no comment.
All right. So, very, very interesting. You're asking me? Prime Meat.
Wait. Patrick?
No.
First date with Ann Saxelby.
Where did I have it?
He probably went to Essex Market.
Vinegar Hill.
Are you serious?
Yeah, that is a good date.
That was your first date?
Yep.
Oh, nice.
God, this is going to last forever, this thing. This is why they are the first couple of the slow food movement.
And she's tried to break up with me a bunch of times. That's usually in Red Hook.
far away from transportation.
Yeah, exactly.
Good job.
But if you had to pick a place where breaking up restaurants over the years.
Tia Pole.
Interesting. Huh. Interesting.
You know, you're all the way on the outside. You're not really sitting at a whole table. People can get up easily.
Mm-hmm.
Quick, kind of semi-standing already.
Quick thing. Superstitions in restaurants I wanted to talk about. I bring up very restaurant-y kind of things every week. And then my thing is whenever glasses break, it's almost like baseball players not being able to hit home runs. Like you'll go through like one day where a busboy will drop an entire thing of glasses and a bartender who's like spot on will break glasses and it'll... Your most senior waiter, and it's so weird because it happens like that.
So what's
and
that? That's not break... superstition. No. That's just bad things.
Just things that happen. And the other superstition is sort of the dictation of the rest of your day by the first customer that you have. It's like the first person that works into your restaurant, like how they act, sort of dictates the rest of your day. Natasha, mm-hmm. anything that comes to your mind?
Yeah, superstitions.
Well, I had actually yesterday. I dropped everything. I was dropping shakers. I was dropping spoons. Dropping, yeah.
Is that just
wait, did you
luck?
Drop that $80 pitcher? Those pitchers?
No, I did not. Oh, God, the day that happens, man, I'm getting fired.
So you don't have any superstitions?
I don't have superstitions.
But do you agree with
me? I have
me,
like
though?
Weird things that I do. Like obsessive
rituals.
Compulsive
yeah.
things so, that
yeah,
I do.
Yeah, what is it? Like what?
Well, I'm very obsessive about how I set up my bar. Yeah. Or like I like I'm sick in the head, so I really like to work service bar.
Yeah.
So I like to save all my tickets. And look at them at the end of the night yeah. and see what I've accomplished.
By the way, I have one saved here.
And then, and see what
by the way,
accomplished.
You need to yeah. tell the runner he needs to change the register.
Yeah.
What's your greatest, what's a great day? What, how do you define a great accomplishment?
I feel like on Friday night, I did something like 600 cocktails.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. That's we looked at, I had them like look at how many cocktails were made that night.
Are you superstitious?
Superstitious? I don't think so. But, you know, it's interesting that you save your dupes because when I was in the kitchen, you always count. You always figure out what you've done. And it's a sense of pride. You know, you have your badge of honor and that's built up with those dupes. So I like that. I like that you do that. Definitely full moon fever.
Oh, really?
Yes, for
wait,
sure.
Wait,
it was
wait,
a full moon.
Quick question.
Full
if you
moon
didn't
last
know,
night.
If you didn't
were
know,
crazy the last couple
cuckoo.
Days.
When I was
cuckoo.
Bartending, if you didn't know it was a full moon, and like so there would be times
oh,
I'd be bartending and I would talk to the server, I'd be like, can you go outside and tell me
yeah, exactly yeah, yeah, what's yeah. the moon
like,
what? Doing?
I can totally tell it's a yeah. full moon because like it's like, how do you know that?
Do
like,
you know, I think that could be an archetype, like a Jungian archetype where it's in everyone's head that when it's a full moon, it's kind of like carte blanche to act a little
people
crazy.
They're just pulled to it and they do their little howl and however they're gonna do it. And you are there and you're
Sam Jr. who's staying with me took his shirt off at dinner and I thought that was inappropriate. Yeah. But then I asked the waiter and it was a full moon.
Two things. One is, who is this gentleman with you? Can you introduce him a
yeah,
little more?
Yeah, Sam Jr. Okay. is Sam S. Wallace Edwards and Sons, who are the great ham curers of Virginia for the past 80 years.
Oh, yes.
His
oh,
great grandfather awesome. Sold ham sandwiches on the ferry between Surrey and Williamsburg.
You're doing that Siriano ham, yes. yeah, which Polino signed on the menu for.
Oh, very, very nice. And why don't you? So I have to say, I'm only superstitious about, I always think that the people who built our bed didn't build it right. So I'm always afraid the build is going to collapse on my two Scotty dogs. So I always put books under there.
Are you serious?
And then I also always make sure that the fire, I'll always lock the door, leave, and then come back and make sure all the coffee's off. And then that the toilet is closed. Because God forbid they're out of water and they jump in the toilet and then they can't get out. And they
you're
drown.
Like Jack
that's
Nicholson.
It.
You're like
that's
Jack
everything.
Nicholson and As Good As It Gets. You're like turning
but
your
but that's everything.
Times.
It's just those three. I conduct a normal life. I drive places. I interact with people. You know, I don't carry germicide.
Mayo, you didn't talk a little bit about this, but you made something, baked something for us today.
Oh, you know, I thought morning time, it's, you know, who doesn't like a little upside down cake? So it's got, you know, beautiful green figs, which are super ripe and oozy. And then the cherries, it's cherry season. So I put some cherries in bourbon and they're just like perfect right now. So
awesome.
Yeah. A little brown sugar, a little, you know.
Cecilia, superstitions and sales?
Oh, jinxing is
other than
a big
me
one.
Other than me calling you at 7 in the morning,
like, I'm always a little superstitious when I get that phone call at 7 a.m.
and I can tell you're today. Either in or out of the shower when you hit like the it goes two rings and it goes right to voicemail.
I'm
like
oh, what the hell? I'm on my delivery. No, superstition is the second that anybody at work ever is like, man, deliveries are going great this week.
Yeah. It's the so restaurant. Over. That's more, I mean, that's more restaurant gods than superstitions. The restaurant gods, like, fear well on you.
Do you get mad at them now when they say that?
Yeah, no, it's, like, not allowed in the office.
And do they
never
come back
like,
and say that there's no real connection? Has anyone ever said there's no real connection between saying that?
No, because it's a...
especially on a Friday.
I would like to say it's, like, a proven fact.
Especially
that,
on a
like,
Friday, when you're, like, Friday's smooth, it's 11, and, like, everything's going good, and you're
done.
Waiting for that one call of something.
And, yeah, no, and you're, like, ready to leave at 5, and everyone's like, man, this is a great day. And then you get that guy who's like, I never got my order today. At all.
Yeah.
Nothing.
And then your Friday turns into 10 when you have to get a cab and drive
everything. Center,
especially there.
Never happens to us, though.
Awesome. Well, Patrick, this has been
a good show.
It's been a great show.
Yeah, good job, Jason. I had nothing to do with this. I only corrected the spelling on consider, and I could have corrected it on Maialino, which is M-A-I-A.
West Pollet, Vermont was another one.
West Pollet. But no, I definitely have to thank the panel because these are three amazing
really
women
good.
That work.
We should make this an annual tradition. Every August, we get these same three cats in here and we'll have different alcohols, different restaurants being talked about.
Well, they're all. These are all movers and shakers. If they want to do the show, if we're too good, if they're not doing like Jimmy Fallon or something, showing them how to make a cocktail or something.
Right. Have you been on Jimmy Fallon?
No.
It's coming.
But she was. You were voted. One of the hottest bar. I hate to use that word. What did the Post say?
The New York Post. While I was working at Polina's, actually, I was one of the hottest bartenders.
And it was a Post, so they did say the hottest.
Can you stand up and turn around? Can we see if we agree?
I hate to be so crass, but other than that, the credentials of this group are amazing. And
this was one of the top 10 shows you've ever
put
together.
Being hot is a credential, by the way.
In the theater of life.
I have friendships. I care a lot about these people that are here in the room, and they're all just really people I respect a lot, and I visit a lot, and I share ideas with, and that's it, Patrick. I don't know, you know, if
that was one of the top four most sincere things I've heard today
from me. other than Ann saying, "Can you let the dogs out?" Like, yeah, I did it. Don't worry.
Yeah, it's out. All right. Well, thanks so much. And next week we're gonna have Christopher Bear from Brooklyn Larder and some
Katie,
other people.
Katie Howard.
Katie Holmes, great.
Katie Howard.
Katie Howard from Don Sitter Bardwell. Well, thanks so much for listening. Thanks to Kane 5. And thank you, ladies, for coming out on an early Sunday morning.
Cheers. Thanks.
Every spring at the end of kidding season, goat dairies across the country are faced with the question of what to do with their male bucklings. Because on a dairy farm, there's no role for a male. Often the most economical thing for these farmers to do is to cull the animals at birth or ship them off to the commodity market. Heritage Foods USA is embarking on a new project, No Goat Left Behind, looking to step in and fill this niche by creating a marketplace for these male bucklings. Visit us at www.heritagefoodsusa.com to learn more and to reserve your goat this coming October.
New York Night Train, Summer Soul Shindig, Rockaway Beach Party, featuring the 45 RPM soul magic of DJ Jonathan Tobin. Saturday, August 20th, 6 to 9 at Rippers, Boardwalk 86. Free party!